Build our cars with Nissan Intelligent Mobility. Inside the first ever Nissan Kicks, technology is designed around you, like available Android Auto, so you can use your phone to access music, maps, and send messages all hands-free, and still pay attention to see what's happening here, here, and here. But no matter how much tech we put in our cars, we'll always keep you in the driver's seat. The first ever Nissan Kicks, starting at just $17,990. Now the most exciting tech you own is in your driveway.
Availability of features varies by vehicle model year, model, trim level, packaging, and options. $17,990 starting MSRP excludes tax, title, license, and destination charge. Dealer sets actual price. Requires the Android Auto app on Google Play and an Android-compatible smartphone running Android 5.0 Lollipop or higher. See owner's manual for more information on Nissan Connect and hands-free text messaging assistant features, or call 1-888-858-8319. Android and Android Auto are trademarks of Google LLC.
Fall is here, and it's a beautiful time to connect with nature, family, friends, and yourself. Head over to Napa Hot Yoga to hone your flexibility and balance. Take advantage of Napa Hot Yoga's one-month fall special. $79 gets you unlimited monthly classes. Visit Napa Hot Yoga at 1660 Silverado Trail or online at NapaHotYoga.com. Napa Hot Yoga, bend beyond.
Van Winden Landscaping, serving the Napa Valley since 1951 with professional landscaping, renovation, and planning. A complete landscaping service, including lighting and pruning, with free estimates. Van Winden sells bulk landscape material to the public as well as to contractors. Open mornings at 8 a.m., afternoons till 5 p.m. Monday through Friday, and 9 till 2 on Saturdays. Van Winden Landscaping at 3101 California Boulevard will meet your total landscaping needs. Big game tickets are available at the two local public high schools. And this is a sports report with Ira C. Smith. This Friday night will be big game number 47. You can get tickets ahead of time at Napa High and at Vintage High School. The game tickets will go on sale Friday at Memorial Stadium at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. The gates will open at 4 o'clock. KVON will be broadcasting the little big game. That's the JV game. Neither team has lost in the league. 4:30 is there. Airtime for the broadcast. Following that will be the varsity action on KVON around 7:30. Stanford is back in the Associated Press College Football Poll at number 24 this week. Utah, number 23. But Alabama is still number 1. Clemson is up to number 2. Notre Dame is number 3. LSU, number 4. Michigan, 5. Texas, 6. Georgia, 7. And Oklahoma is 8. Ohio State, by the way, after losing to Purdue, dropped down to number 11. Bruce Koepka is golf's new number one. He replaces Dustin Johnson as the world's top-ranking golfer. Koepka repeated as U.S. Open champion. He won the PGA Championship and was named the PGA Tour Player of the Year. Earlier this week, former U.S. World Cup goldkeeper Tim Howard had his fifth shutout of the season, leading Colorado Rapids to a tie with the San Jose Earthquakes, 0-0 at Avaya Stadium. San Jose, 4 wins, 20 losses, 9 ties, the worst team in the Western Conference. Tonight it's San Jose Sharks hockey at Nashville. You can hear the broadcast on KVON beginning at 5 o'clock this evening. The Sharks at Nashville. Tomorrow night it'll be Golden State Warriors basketball. Yeah, Warriors are home to the Washington Wizards. 7:30 airtime for the broadcast on KVON. And the World Series underway tonight at Boston, the Dodgers and the Red Sox.
Okay.
Years of drought, millions of dead trees, extreme winds, and leading scientists say there will be even more dangerous fires in the years ahead. Our weather is changing, and we all need to work together to get ready. Hi, I'm Lisa Velis-Waweru from PG&E. At PG&E, we are accelerating our forest management work in high fire threat areas, removing dead trees and trimming vegetation back 12 feet from power lines. As part of our community wildfire safety program, we are implementing additional safety measures to further reduce wildfire risks, including a 24-hour wildfire safety operations center, new early warning weather stations, and stronger power lines in high fire threat areas. And we want to make sure you know what steps you can take, like cutting back vegetation around your home, having the right emergency plan, and signing up for safety alerts. For more information on how to keep you and your neighborhood safe, visit pge.com/wildfire safety.
The San Jose Sharks are in action tonight. They're playing at Nashville. You can hear the broadcast on KVON beginning at 5 o'clock this evening. That's the San Jose Sharks at Nashville on KVON tonight.
I'm Nate Campbell, updating you on some stories we are following in the KVON newsroom. And we start with news out of the North Bay Business Journal. A dip in hotel occupancy in September. Napa County's rates saw a decline of 5.4%. Sonoma County has been more up than down this year in its occupancy rates compared to 2017. Senator Dodd reflecting 1 year ago.
A year ago, we had the North Bay firestorms, and that really incredibly impacted four counties besides ours right here in Napa, and nobody did a particularly good job of early warning at all. Of course, we had a lot of challenges. When the power goes out, it goes out to the cell towers. When the cell towers get burned and the fiber optic cables melt, communication kind of drops out altogether. So we didn't really do a very good job.
Napa Valley College will host a joint legislative hearing on insurance and wildfires with Senator Dodd. He'll be joined by leaders of the Assembly and Senate Insurance Committees. It's October 30th. They'll examine whether homeowners insurance coverage has been sufficient to rebuild for those affected by the fire. And some Valley of the Moon headlines. Glen Ellen's real estate market is proving fireproof. Aaron Hawkins has been named co-director for Hannah Institute. And MidPen has broken ground on senior apartments in Sonoma. For more on these stories, go to sonomanews.com. Napa in the North Bay, you are up to date. I'm Nate Campbell. That's the news.
Everyone's a Finkel friend on Judd's Napa Valley Show.
Get ready for another heapful of fascinating things to know from witty and intriguing people on Judd's Napa Valley Show. No stale script and no rehearsing, live from a Napa studio. You may be that intriguing person on Judd's Napa Valley Show. On Judd's Napa Valley Show. Judd's Napa, Judd's Napa Valley, Judd's Napa Valley Show.
Procrastination is the art of keeping up with yesterday. And now, live
from the 1440 KVON studios at Broadcast Park in the beautiful Napa Valley, it's Judd's Napa Valley Show. I'm Lauren Mole, and here's your host, Judd Finkelstein.
Good morning, Lauren Mole. How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine. Judd, top of the day.
Top of the day. What is new in the world of Lauren?
Well, my gosh, Judd, I've just been working a lot at Knob Hill these last few days.
Yeah, that's a good thing, right? Getting some hours.
That's
putting
right.
A little paycheck in the bank account?
Actually, yes.
Actually, good. Glad to hear. And things are good. You always enjoy seeing all the folks that come by. I know a lot of people know you now as Lauren Mole, Mr. Napa Valley TV and radio.
That's right.
That's right. Well, good.
Thanks. And also, well, we're gearing up to do some singing events with Cindy Skinner at the Napa Valley Voices this coming December, December 8th through the 15th. We're performing at restaurants and retirement homes.
Very good. Will you let us know as that gets a little closer if there's opportunity for some of the listeners, some of your fans to come out and see you?
Actually, I think these might be private events.
Jeff. Oh, boy. Plug in those private events. Okay.
Well, I'm so sorry.
So you'll let us know when they are so we can sneak in and crash the party.
Well, that I could. But also, Judd, I hate to say this, but I have a confession to make.
Uh-oh.
For the first time since 2012... Since Kelly Fuller left the morning show at KVYN, I've been offered a volunteer voiceover position there.
Have you really? Wow, that's great.
Yes, so now you'll hear me at 10 a.m. every Friday with Big Rick Stewart for the 10 at 10 on the Vine.
Great. Oh, that's very exciting. The new feature. Fantastic. Looking forward to hearing you.
Oh, thanks. So what's been going on with you, Judd?
Well, I'm going to quickly tell you what's going on because we have got a caller on the line. I really hope. We were having a few issues before we went on the air, but hopefully our caller is there. But I want to let folks know that some fun things coming up. You know, first I want to start with a quote. This is something that our frequent guest, Dr. Alan Steen, has brought up about the importance of travel. And he talks about how travel breaks down, you know, barriers to just to life. It gives you perspective. It gets you to meet people, see what other cultures are like, give you an appreciation. And he often quoted Mark Twain. So I went and found the full quote. And Mark Twain, in Innocence Abroad, wrote, "Travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness, and many of our people need it sorely on these accounts. Broad, wholesome, charitable views of men and things cannot be acquired by vegetating in one little corner of the earth all one's lifetime."
Oh, that's interesting.
And I couldn't agree more. It is so important to break out of the little bubbles that we impose ourselves into to get a little perspective. And whether that means traveling internationally or just doing things you wouldn't normally do just right around here. You know, check out a cultural festival, see a museum, go to a restaurant that serves a type of food you wouldn't normally like. I'm not going to get up on a soapbox, but I think it's so important to just get out and gain some perspective. So I'm going to give a couple things coming up to get out of one's perspective. One is my own band, the Mike High Gents, is playing at Trader Vic's Sunday. It's a brunch, Sunday, November 4th. So for those of you who have never been to a tiki-style event, this would be a great way to experience that, as there are going to be two rooms full of vendors with you know, artists, ceramics, aloha ware, wood carving, and it's called the Bazaar Brunch. Bazaar, like a marketplace. And again, that will be at Trader Vic's in Emeryville, Sunday, November 4th. And my band is playing in the lounge from 11 till 2, our old-time Hawaiian music. If you'd like to make a reservation, there's no cover charge, but if you want to make sure you have a seat, call Trader Vic's at 510-653-3400. Then another event coming up, actually sooner, this very coming Saturday, which is a great chance for people, well, in and out of the community to gain a little perspective on something. It's a Jewish Vintners, an evening of Jewish Vintners, sponsored by the synagogue here in town, Congregation Beth Shalom. And you don't have to be Jewish to come enjoy this. There are going to be 16 different Vintners, dinner by Chef, I had it written down. Where is it? I should know it. Oh, David Nayfield. That's who it is, from San Francisco. And Itamar Abramovich as well, former guest who headed up the effort to feed the fire victims and first responders last year, will be cooking. There will be a walk-around tasting. That's, again, this coming Saturday, October 27th. The walk-around tasting is from 4 to 6. Dinner from 6:30 to 9:30. As I said, 16 different vintners. Cheese curated, that's the word of the day, curated by another former guest, Janet Fletcher. Music by Jealous Zelig. It's going to be a great time. If anybody's interested in experiencing that, go to the website cbsnapa.org. And then, of course, I invite folks to come to Judd's Hill and visit me. Still the number one thing to do on TripAdvisor when you're in Napa Valley is visit Judd's Hill. And I couldn't be more proud of the customer experience we have put together, the hospitality, and of course, the quality of the wines. That's what I've got to say, but we've got a great guest. Fingers crossed he is on the line, and we're going to give him an introduction right now, and then I guess we'll find out for sure if he's on the line. And Lauren, would you do the honors?
This instructor don't teach round no campfire, and it's feared that his final exam's dire. But Bob Cumbaugh's subject cinematic keeps the audience squirming and not static, because he's known as Professor Vampire.
Professor Vampire. Bob Cumbo, are you there on the line, sir?
I am.
Okay, good. We can hear you. At least I could hear you. And Bob, you are joining us. You're calling in from the beautiful city of Seattle, Washington. How are things up there?
I can't tell. It's so foggy.
Well, that's perfect. That sets the scene for what we're going to talk about, the little gloominess. We called you Professor Vampire in the introduction. You are a man who writes film, film critique, film appreciation, and you even teach courses and have taught courses at Seattle University you've taught about Westerns, horror movies, Stanley Kubrick, but you also have designed a course in the vampire film. So that's what we're really going to focus on today.
Right.
And I think
all of this in addition to my day job, which you know about.
And I think I'll give that as well. You know, we have worked together because, Bob, this is Judd's Napa Valley show, and you're calling in from Seattle. But you do have a connection here. You and I have worked together for the better part of 20 years. You are a renowned trademark attorney, and you you work with us, and you work within the wine industry and some other entities here in Napa Valley. So you're no stranger to this area and what we do here. But I only found out about this other side of you just in the last couple of years, that you are this, a film buff from way back, and for 40-so years, apparently, have been, I've seen proof, I've seen some of your writings, have been immersed in the world of film, film appreciation, and critique.
That's correct.
How did you get on this line? Was this something you picked up while in law school? Did this predate your law career? Give us a little background on your life in film, and then we're going to pop into vampires.
I don't know that I ever had a life in film. I had a life in movies.
Okay. And
watching movies.
All right.
And I don't know. I get asked this question a lot. How did you get into movies? I've always been into movies, and I think it's because I grew up in the Army. My dad was an Army officer, and we moved from Army base to Army base, and Army bases tended in those days, and maybe still do, have lots of movie theaters.
Uh-huh, yes.
And lots of movies keep moving through those theaters. It's not like a downtown theater where the same thing is playing for 3 weeks. You would see a movie on Sunday and Monday, and then a new one on Tuesday, and then a new one on Wednesday, Thursday,
and then
a new one on Friday, and a new one on Saturday. You could ideally see 6 movies a week, and there wasn't a lot else to do on Army bases. There was the swimming pool, and there was this and that, the library and so on. But the thing that I loved to do most with my friends, my other military-dependent friends, was go to movies, and I just got used to seeing a lot of movies and learning about them, and they became part of the fabric of my consciousness, for better or worse.
Well, you know, I always enjoyed talking with you on legal issues, which sounds fun. And my interactions with other attorneys I work with, it's not always a fun conversation. But for some reason, there was this air about you. And even though I didn't know you were this movie guy, I felt we were connecting on some level. And then it all made sense once I realized, we're on the same page. Because when we talked about movies, we really seemed to enjoy a lot of the same things. So to give the listeners, if they haven't been listening all month, a little background. Last year, we did not get to do a Halloween show. Lauren and I were in emergency broadcasting mode because of the fires, and we always enjoyed doing our Halloween shows in the past. So we decided this month, every show is a Halloween show. So I reached out to you, Bob, so we could talk about vampire films. And you had designed a course that you've taught at Seattle University, all about the vampire film. So I thought, let's talk about them. Let's get into this. You sent me the syllabus, and it's really quite amazing. Beyond the writing requirements that you have of your students, there are films, required films, and there are 22 different films that you are requiring your students to watch. So I want to talk about some of them. I've seen many of them since we decided to do this. I tried to look up a few, and I'm excited. Sounds odd, but I enjoy the vampire. I like a good vampire film. To me, those are the kind of the vampire to me represents sort of the pinnacle of the movie monster. And we can get into why that is in a little bit. But what inspired you about vampires to put a whole course together?
Wow. Good question. First, I wanted to point out on what you were just saying, that the syllabus that I sent you was from the second time I taught vampires, and I didn't realize it at the time, but that syllabus significantly does not include the film Twilight or anything from the Twilight series. First time I taught vampire film, I said to myself it would be irresponsible to teach a course in the vampire movie and not include Twilight because it's such a huge phenomenon.
Right.
By the second time I taught vampire film, a couple years later, the backlash had set in. Everybody was sick and tired of Twilight, and I figured this was a good opportunity to leave it out of the course. And what I did instead was I assigned a number of special projects. I invited the class to break themselves up into groups and each one take on a special project. And one of those special projects was the Twilight series.
Mm.
And so we had a 20-minute presentation on the Twilight series instead of watching and talking about Twilight.
Well, Twilight's a big target.
I wanted to tell you that because you said you looked at the syllabus and you wanted to talk about some of the films. Please feel free to talk about some of the films that are not there as well.
Okay, very good. Well, you can bring them up too. I am curious about how you set this up. You know, it starts, it's in chronological order, and it starts in 1922 with the classic, really one of my favorite films, F.W. Murnau's Nosferatu, which predates, I think, would you call this the first significant vampire on film?
Absolutely.
Is that why that's number one?
Nosferatu is the first important movie vampire. There were a lot of little movies of so-and-so the vampire and that sort of thing. But Nosferatu was the first big one. And Nosferatu was actually, which most people who have read the literature know, was actually a version of Dracula. And
not just a version of Dracula, but basically it was so close to the original that they didn't get a chance to make another movie for fear of getting sued. Isn't that correct?
That's correct. They actually wanted to make Dracula, and they couldn't get the approval of the Bram Stoker estate. And what they did was they just changed some names. Count Dracula became Count Orlok, and each one of the characters still had a similar name, but they were different names, and little parts of the plot were tweaked here and there, but fundamentally it's still the same story, and the Stoker estate still sued them, and so they had some problems.
And unfortunately we didn't get a chance to see, I would have loved to have seen some follow-ups through here, but they closed down the studio. And did Murnau do many more films? I actually don't know what happened to him after.
Murnau did many more films.
He did.
Murnau
okay.
went to Hollywood, where he directed one of the greatest films ever made, an American classic called Sunrise. Gorgeous silent film, and it is sort of a version of Theodore Dreiser's American Tragedy. I think Murnau is one of the most forgotten formative directors of motion picture art. He is just amazing. Every time I look at a Murnau film, I think, why is this guy not on everybody's lips, right up there with Hitchcock and D.W. Griffith and John Ford?
Well, thanks for educating me. I'm going to look for some of these. I was so impressed with Nosferatu. I remember watching it as a teen for the first time and being pretty creeped out, and revisited it last year around Halloween time, watched it straight through. And again, for a silent film, no dialogue, it's a scary movie. It got to me.
Murnau was very, very good with creepy. He also did a film of Faust, Goethe's Faust, and it's amazingly spooky.
Ooh, okay. Definitely we'll look for that one. Moving along chronologically, you can steer this as well, but
let's stay with Nosferatu for a moment.
Okay, sure.
Because I know that one of the things you're particularly interested in that you mentioned to me outside of this interview is how the image of the vampire changed. So I'd like to say a little bit about the image that we're given of the vampire in Nosferatu. That is, he's sort of a personification of disease.
Mm-hmm.
When he arrives in the little town that he ends up virtually destroying, he is accompanied by lots and lots of rats.
That's right.
And so it's sort of a symbol of disease, but it also, he has a rat-like face himself, and longer fangs than we usually see in vampires, but we're accustomed to the more romantic vampires, Bela Lugosi and Christopher Lee and Frank Langella. But Max Schreck, a very mysterious character who played this role, was just hideously frightening visually, and was emblematic of the vampire as a corrupter of human beings, of human society, and an evil that must be destroyed.
Ooh.
And I wanted to emphasize that because that's where the movie Vampire starts. That's the beginning of our perception of the vampire, that it's something evil and we've got to stomp it out.
Well, then let's not go movie by movie. Let's go through the evolution, and you can bring up examples, because it starts as this, as you say, this this monster who symbolizes plague, pestilence, disease, and does make this evolution into popular culture to become somewhat of a romantic, a bit of a sex symbol at times. And then when you get to Twilight, sort of the sullen teen. Do you want to talk about how this progressed throughout moviedom? This is your show. I want you to give us a little bit of the combo vampire treatment with some specific examples of movies along the way so people can do their Halloween viewing.
Well, the way they evolve is very interesting. And, of course, with any film genre, the genre actually is more indicative of the time in which the film was made and the audiences for which the films were made than it is of the time that it's about. So, for the Westerns are the most obvious example. Westerns usually take place somewhere between 1840 and 1900, but they're never about American history. They're never about the reality of the Old West. They're about a mythology that can be molded like clay and used to present stories to different generations of people for different reasons.
Okay.
So the Westerns have different agendas from one generation to the next. So does the vampire film. And so after Nosferatu, of course, Bram Stoker's novel Dracula was a sensation and remained a sensation and became a stage play during the 20s. And the star of that stage play was this barely known Hungarian actor, Bela Lugosi, who so absorbed the part of Dracula and what we think of as the vampire that he had to be in the movie as well, and that started his somewhat tragic movie career. But Lugosi is this suave, urbane, Hungarian or Romanian, in the case of the vampire, count. He's nobility, and he has manners, and he has a style that suggests elegance. But he lives in this stone castle with dirt and rats running around, and of course he seriously drinks people's blood, and so there's a kind of a romantic appeal about him. At the same time, it's a fatal romanticism. The classic vampire figure is not really Nosferatu. It's the Lugosi Dracula, the polished noble who has a deep, dark secret that he tries to hide from others, but it's also an urge that he's got that he has to fulfill, and sooner or later, the vampire hunters are going to catch up with him.
Right, and
so
I...
the vampire hunter becomes kind of an important figure.
Okay.
In those early Universal Dracula films. And we keep this attitude toward the vampire of elegant nobility with a nasty, dangerous sense underlying. And by the way, that's why the vampire film, at least for a long time, is about class, as well as being about vampires and evil and human beings and all the other things that it's about. It's also about class. For decades, the vampire is always a figure of nobility. Right up until the mid-60s, you've still got vampires who are figures of nobility. The vampire in Roman Polanski's The Fearless Vampire Killers, 1966, is also a count. And he has all of these elegant friends, and he has a big party. Actually, the original title of the film, and a better title in my mind, it was Dance of the Vampires. And it's a big ball that the vampires are having, into which come these vampire hunters who are a sort of a comic duo that don't do anything quite right and end up bringing vampirism back into the world with them instead of destroying the vampires. But anyway, this notion of the class that a vampire has kind of sticks with us.
I would like to mention that there's a famous series of vampire movies done by the Hammer Studios, the Hammer Horror series, that pretty much shot Christopher Lee to stardom. And the one that kicks it off, Horror of Dracula, from the late 50s, 57, 58.
57.
I almost wish they had spent a little more time, as much as I really like that movie, and I would recommend anybody who likes vampire movies and the story of Dracula. It's a great movie, great film. Christopher Lee, Peter Cushing as Van Helsing, phenomenal. I just wish there was a little more exposition at the beginning to really build up that character of Dracula as this noble man of class. They show him in the castle. They have him hire, you know, who else would hire a librarian to come work for him? So they give you some hints, but I just wish there was slightly more development of that character, and then off to the races. And I just wish there was a little more Dracula in general in that movie. He's almost becomes like the protagonist, like they're looking for him, but you know, I'd like to see him a little more. But that's me.
Exactly. And this is the way the image of the vampire changes. Christopher Lee is even sexier and more alluring than Bela Lugosi was in his day. And the women in the film go for him.
Oh, boy,
and
do they.
They're all too eager to be seduced by him. He doesn't have to work too hard at being a vampire.
No, it's amazing. There's no resistance.
And the movie is only 81 minutes long, which is probably why you sense some background lacking. And I think they made it the way they made it, because it's not the Dracula story. It's the same characters, but in a very different sort of plot.
Right, right.
But I think they assumed that by the time they came out with Horror of Dracula in 57, that everybody knew the basic plot of Dracula and the basic background of the vampire, and that might not have been a safe assumption. There were also things that they couldn't do because of Universal's rights in the previous Lugosi series of vampire films, and so they had to be cautious. And at the same time, Stoker's novel was by now in the public domain, so they could do anything they wanted with those characters, and that's what they did. And interestingly enough, there is a sense in which Horror of Dracula is not just a vampire film, but also a vampire hunter film. We're really, really interested in Cushing.
Oh yeah, he's a great
character, Van Helsing, and he's after Dracula from the very beginning. Whereas in the classic Dracula story, Van Helsing doesn't appear until sometime along the way when he tells people, "This thing that you're worried about, this is real. This is not some old myth or superstition. This is a real thing, and it's happening to us. Now, if you guys want to get on board and help me destroy it, let's go to work." And that's the kind of vampire hunter we get during the 50s and 60s. And the vampire hunters are kind of on balance with the vampires themselves as being interesting figures, interesting characters.
Hold that thought, Bob, because we... Unfortunately, on the radio, we got to pay some bills. We got to take a quick break, just a couple minutes. But let's come back and talk how the vampire hunters come to the same level as the vampires themselves, shall we?
Fine.
Okay, Lauren.
You're listening to Judd's Napa Valley Show. We'll be right back after these messages.
Do you like Spanish music?
Oh, yeah! Yeah.
I mean, real Spanish music. The latest hits. Oldies. Muchachi. Mariachi. Salsa. Then listen to me, Nicolás de Luna de Haro, every Sunday morning on KVON 1440 AM.
Smart Radio.
The best music, interviews, news, and a whole lot more. Domingos con Nico, La Voz del Valle, every Sunday morning at 6.
I can't hear you, but I assume you can hear me.
I have to tell you about this. A few days ago, I really needed several $1,000
so
fast.
So
I called 844-7 Loan Me.
I'm going to pick up where we left off and
talk
before, a little bit
but
more
Loan
about
Me was different.
Hunter,
first of all, my agent was very calm and clearly explained everything about the loan. He said I didn't need perfect credit and I didn't need any collateral. Okay. He said I could make fixed monthly payments or I could repay it at any time with no penalties or fees. Okay. Then he said if I wanted to use the cash for up to 7 days and then repay it, Loan Me would not charge me any fees or interest. Zero. I said, could you repeat that? Because it sounds too good to be true. So he did. And so I took out the loan, got the money in about 4 hours, and used the cash for 6 days. And then I repaid it. And they charged me nothing. Amazing. Loan Me really is different.
Hablamos español.
Minimum loan amount, $2,600. Go to loanme.com for our privacy policy terms and conditions. Loans made pursuant to California Department of Business Oversight Finance Lender License 603K061.
Call 844-7-LOAN-ME. That's 844-7-LOAN-ME.
A Night with Janis Joplin is coming to the Lincoln Theater on October 24th. Come see this Tony Award-nominated Broadway show and celebrate her life, music, legacy, and her influences like Aretha Franklin, Etta James, Odetta, Nina Simone, and Bessie Smith, all who acted as inspirations for Janis Joplin to become a true rock and roll legend. Get your tickets online today at LincolnTheater.org.
Join 99.3 The Vine and me for free ice cream sandwiches. The grand opening of Cream going down this weekend, Saturday, October 27th at 145 Gasser Drive. You know, by the movies.
I used to leave voicemails for myself because the only one I could trust to get something done right was me.
Hey, you, it's me. Remember to order safety goggles and grab some milk on your way home.
But now I use Grainger. Grainger's got the technical support you'd expect from America's number one source for industrial-grade supplies. They're in the business of helping my business, so no more talking to myself. Now, I talk to Grainger, because when it comes to keeping your business running, Grainger's got your back. Call or click Grainger.com to see for yourself. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Judd's Napa Valley Show. Every episode, a veritable cornucopia of Finkel fun.
You're listening to 1440 KVON, the voice of Napa Valley. Now, back to Judd's Napa Valley Show.
Thank you, Lauren Mole. And on the phone joining us from Seattle, Washington, is Bob Cumbo, who, among many other talents, has taught a course in vampire films at Seattle University. So we're talking vampires. And Bob, we left off before the break with talking about vampire hunters and vampires kind of sharing the starring role. So you want to continue on that tack?
Absolutely. One of the films, probably the least known film in my syllabus, but a film that I love teaching, is a film by Brian Clemens from 1974 called Captain Kronos, Vampire Hunter. And it's a fascinating film because the vampire hunter is the main character. And it's kind of like a Western almost, but it takes place in classic 19th century Britain. And the vampires don't suck blood. They suck life. And there's a very scary beginning in which a young woman is attacked and ages in just moments before your eyes and crumbles. Horrible image, but this vampire family is, again, a part of the nobility. They live in a castle outside of town, and this has come to the attention of Captain Kronos, and he comes to town with his assistant, and they go about bringing down the family of vampires. It's the only film that I know of where the vampire hunter is actually the primary character. In most of them, the vampire films of this era, 1930s through the 70s, the vampire hunter and the vampire himself are equal, or the vampire is the more interesting character. We got into this as we were talking about the evolution of the vampire himself, however, and so I want to mention a couple of more landmarks in our changing perception of the vampire. One of the big ones is 1977. George Romero, famous for six zombie movies, also made a vampire movie, and it's called Martin. It's an excellent, excellent film, and it's about a teenager who, throughout the entire film, you don't know, is he really a vampire, or does he just think he's a vampire, and so he does the things that vampires do, and he's afraid of the things that vampires are afraid of, but we don't know, is he actually having a psychological condition rather than being physically a vampire. And that ambiguity is maintained throughout the whole thing. And it's a generational kind of thing, too, because his grandfather, whom he lives with, believes that the kid is a vampire.
Does
the
this
kid
have...
believes okay. most of the time that he's a vampire, but what we believe is always kind of up in the air.
So is this a little more
film, and
psychological?
30 years before Twilight.
30 years before Twilight. And is this more psychological? I think George Romero, you know, he puts a lot of gore in your face if you watch Night of the Living Dead, Dawn of the Dead, Day of the Dead, and so on. And this is between Night of the Living Dead and Dawn of the Dead. So how does this figure stylistically in his repertoire?
It's very different. There's it's in a very subdued sort of color with black and white flashbacks interlaced, and the black and white flashbacks are memories that this kid thinks he has because he thinks he's an eternal vampire, and it deals with the classical Lugosi mode of vampirism that this kid is trying to recreate, but it's not working.
Okay.
There's special interest to this show and your audience. There's a radio talk show tracking the vampire. They call him the Count. This mysterious vampire killer, who is this teenage kid, actually. And all of these people are phoning into the radio station saying, I think I know who the Count is. And it's a fun movie, but it's a very disturbing movie, and it's a revolutionary movie for its time.
And that's called Martin.
That's called Martin, yes. Okay. And it's a revolutionary movie for its time because 2 years later, John Badham makes Dracula, the first big remake of Dracula since the Hammer films of the 50s, with Frank Langella.
Yes.
And Frank Langella is even sexier than Christopher Lee or Bela Lugosi ever dreamed of. And Frank Langella has his, under his cape, bare chest, and his cape is, his shirt is always unbuttoned down to the navel, and at the time this movie came out, women were swooning for Frank Langella.
Yeah, did you take your wife
Dracula.
To this?
And this was a big turn in the image of the screen vampire, because he was this really seductive, romantic figure whom audiences cared about more than they cared about the vampire hunters. And the vampire hunters end up being somewhat less successful in this film, and whether the ending means that the vampire survives or not is also a bit of ambiguity, but there's no question at all that the audience's sympathies are mostly with the vampire just because he's so gorgeous.
And
after that,
can I stop just for a second? Because I'm curious. You were talking about speaking to a generation, and there is a film on here that aesthetically and the music is pretty incredible too. It's a French film. It goes out of what the Americans do with vampires, but it's The Shiver of the Vampire, and I'm not sure I let myself go with this movie, or I totally understood what was going on. But what I did really enjoy was the fact that I felt like I was in 1971 in France, and the fashions were really groovy, and there was this kind of psychedelic acid rock and roll going on in the background throughout this just very strange few days in a castle where all kinds of seductions take place. And I'm curious why you put that into your syllabus.
It's like classic vampire culture meets hippie culture. It's
yeah.
a really, really interesting film. I put it into my sequence because Jean Rollin is a really, really interesting figure. And from the late 60s...
That's the director of this film.
Through Yes,
yeah.
The director of Shiver the Vampire. He made a whole cycle of these... I shouldn't say cycle, because the films aren't connected to one another. They don't have the same characters. But every time he made a movie, it was another erotic vampire movie. And these were erotic movies. They had... They were not bashful about nudity, but they weren't vampire porn either. They were vampire movies in which Rollin satirized in a darkly subtle way the changing norms of his time, including hippie culture, including the sexual revolution, including the changing view of class tensions, because his vampires are still generally upper-class people,
yeah.
and they're trying to preserve a way of life that for them is eternal, but different generations have come and gone and done different things to them and made them feel differently. So it's almost like vampirism is a club that has to unite and protect itself. And that particular theme actually is echoed in 2012 in Neil Jordan's Byzantium, which is my very favorite vampire movie, but we'll get there.
We'll get there, but we're going to have to... And I'm glad you mentioned what you just did about Shiver the Vampire, because now I see it in a whole different perspective, and I thank you for that. So we've got about 10 minutes of talk time left, just to give you a guide. If you are available, we can keep talking for a few more minutes. We'll have to go off the air, but we can keep recording for extra podcast content. That's up to you, because I'm fascinated by all this. But let's keep going with the time that we've got. We were at Dracula 1979, talking about the evolution of the vampire character through cinema. Where would you go next?
Okay, well, so Frank Langella is the pinnacle of the on-screen romantic, fatally seductive vampire. That same year, interestingly enough, Werner Herzog, the German director, remade Nosferatu, and it's a very, very close remake, only it's much, much more cynical and frightening for 1979 than for the 1922 Nosferatu, but that was Klaus Kinski, and that kind of went back to the old original image. But another one that was attractive at the time was The Hunger, made by Tony Scott, Ridley's smarter brother, in which Catherine Deneuve is an eternal vampire who in the beginning is with David Bowie, but David Bowie is aging. She doesn't age. Mm. And he's soon out of her life, and she seduces Susan Sarandon, and it's a really, really sexy and erotic vampire film, but the eroticism is female, female to female. And so that brings a new dimension to the female vampire. But moving quickly along, Near Dark, Catherine Bigelow's first big feature hit of 1987, is a bunch of hillbillies who drive around in a camper who are vampires. Really, really different idea of vampires. And here, suddenly, vampires are common folk. They're ordinary people. And so vampirism is something that could happen to anybody. And the main character of the film is a farm boy who just happens to hit up the wrong girl and becomes one of these vampires.
Mm.
And fascinating film. Really, really good film. 2 years after that, Robert Bierman makes Vampire's Kiss with Nicolas Cage. And Nicolas Cage is more in the tone of Martin. He's a guy who has a has a fight with a bat in his apartment in New York early in the film and believes he's been bitten and is certain he's becoming a vampire. And he's having hallucinations. And like Martin, this film sustains the ambiguity. Is he a vampire, or is he just a vampire wannabe, or is he having a breakdown of some sort? It's Nick Cage at his out-of-control best.
okay.
Then Francis Coppola in 1992 makes Stoker's Dracula again, and this time with Gary Oldman. And what is the movie about? It's about an eternal love. It's Dracula has a purpose on Earth. He's not just surviving. He's trying to find his lost love, whom he's sure has been or will be reincarnated at some time, in some place, in some part of eternity, and they'll be together again. Fascinating, daring thing, and a really richly Baroque-looking film.
Yes, I remember it well.
But I want to keep moving with this evolution because it keeps happening. Of course, the next big landmark is Interview with the Vampire in 1994. Neil Jordan, the Irish director, makes this film, and the vampires at this point, both men and women, have become really, really pretty. We've got Tom Cruise and Brad Pitt, and oh my God, it's just, this is an echo of the high class, noble, luscious, seductive, good looking, attractive vampire. But the difference is, we're seeing things from the vampire's point of view. The vampire we're discovering is somebody to be understood and sympathized with. Poor baby, he's a vampire. He can't help it. And this becomes the prevailing attitude about the screen vampire. And a lone voice. We're in the 1990s now. A lone voice in the 1990s is the voice of John Carpenter, who is always kind of a reactionary when it comes to evil. Carpenter's position is evil never dies, and it has to be destroyed repeatedly because it keeps coming back. Vampires are not poor, misunderstood human beings. They are monsters. They are evil, and we got to kill them. So what does he do in Vampires? Once again, the vampire hunters become front and center. And James Woods is the meanest, badass vampire hunter in vampire film ever. But Vampires failed utterly as a film because it didn't show people the vampire that they wanted, the vampire that they were attracted to, and that was just about to be embodied for teenagers in the Twilight saga.
Uh-huh. Here it comes.
So then we have the era of Twilight, and in that era we also have such interesting films as Let the Right One In, Byzantium, and more recently Only Lovers Left Alive and A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night, in all of which the vampire is, if not the lead figure, at least a sympathetic figure, and not only someone who must be understood and sympathized with and appreciated, but someone who becomes an important part of the human race, a protector, a fighter against evil, rather than a bringer of evil. So we've gone completely around the circle since Nosferatu.
That is something. And those last couple you mentioned, let's say them once again. I haven't seen them, but I want to make sure that I write them down. I'm taking notes. Only Lovers Left Alive by Jim Jarmusch.
Only Lovers Left Alive is a Jim Jarmusch film, mm-hmm. and it's about a vampire couple that is eternal. They've been living since somewhere before Egypt. I don't
know. Okay, long time.
But in this film, and it's, being a Jim Jarmusch film, it's sort of tongue-in-cheek and a very, very good film. Tilda Swinton is the main female vampire. It is kind of a satire on vampire films, but it also dares to portray the vampire as a preserver of culture, because these vampires have lived through era after era after era. They're saving what is best. And the woman vampire, Tilda Swinton, is saving literature, and Tom Hiddleston is saving music. And he's creating new music, but he can't put it out there because he has to live this private, secluded life because he's a vampire. Mm. And so he has other people who get his music out there for him. And they're kind of rejuvenating culture. And Girl Walks Home Alone at Night is an Iranian-American vampire film. Actually, Anna Lily Amirpour is completely American, born in California. But she made this film that's set in some nondescript place that could as easily be part of Tehran as part of Los Angeles. And to put it briefly, the girl who walks home alone at night, who is the vampire in this, actually only attacks evil people.
Oh.
And she is kind of saving the world from the bad people.
Wow. Wow. Okay, so, those are going on the list.
But the one that should be at the top of your list is Byzantium. And I think we probably don't have enough time for me to say how much I love Byzantium and why.
If you've got about 1 minute, I'll take the summary.
I will say then, just briefly, Byzantium is an amazing film by Neil Jordan, an Irish director. He makes what is, to my mind, the definitive vampire film. It touches all of the great themes of vampirism, and it manages to be about Britain's subjection of Ireland, the upper class's subjection of the lower class, men's subjection of women, and vampires.
Wow.
And it all goes together amazingly well. It's beautiful. It's also got a very William Butler Yeats poetry feel to it.
Yeah, I would imagine.
As you might guess from the title.
Exactly. I can't believe how quickly this has gone by for me. I would go on another hour or two talking to you about this and getting a little more into some vampire talk, but this has been great for me. I've got a viewing list. Hopefully some of our listeners will appreciate. And we've been talking to Bob Cumbo, who is a film writer and an attorney and a teacher, as we called him earlier, Professor Vampire. And we were talking about some of the movies that he teaches in his course. What is the name of the course at Seattle University? Is it just...
Well, it's a course that I taught. I don't teach it currently.
Okay.
But I called this particular course Vampire Films.
Vampire Films.
Movies, one or the other.
And if you would like, you can look up some of his books available to Amazon or booksellers. He's got The Films of Sergio Leone and another one called Order in the Universe, The Films of John Carpenter. Bob Cumbo, thanks very much, and I'm going to go out and watch some vampire movies.
Thank you, Jared. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
All right. Take care, sir.
All righty.
Bye.
Bye.
This has been Judd's Napa Valley Show, a Gil Lamar production.
811 is a free service to keep our community safe. Before you do any project, big or small, PG&E will come out and mark your gas and electric lines so you don't hit them when you dig. Call 811 before you dig and make sure that you and your neighbors are safe.
Housing discrimination. Would you recognize it and report it? These folks did.
My landlord said rent will be cheaper if we're friends with benefits.
Because I'm legally blind, a landlord questioned whether I'd be capable of maintaining an apartment.